Genesis Questions, the fifth talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on March 19, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
And back in Genesis. One of the things that I like about teaching is when people ask questions, because I end up going away and thinking about those things all week long, quite frequently, and this last week was particularly true. There were several questions that were asked last time, both during the question time and then afterwards. People came up and asked some questions, and I literally spent all week churning away on those questions. Now, as I thought about those questions, it's possible that those questions changed. So I'm not sure that I will be responding now to the actual questions that were asked as much as questions that grew in my mind as I thought about the questions that were asked. But I'd like to respond to two or three of them after I've thought about it in more detail. Dom last week came up afterwards and asked me, he said, it's interesting to think about the psychology involved in Adam and Eve. But when it comes down to it, is it not the case that they simply should have obeyed? Isn't the question ultimately simply obedience? And there's a sense in which I agree with that. That's true. There are many times in my life when I really know what God requires of me, but I have a difficult time bringing myself to the place where I will actually do it. And in those instances, I think the only appropriate thing to do, the thing that I do, the only thing that I know to do, is to preach to myself. Basically, to remind myself of what is true, and what is good and what is right, and therefore what I ought to do. So in that sense, simply obeying makes a lot of sense. I think that's right. But there's another sense in which it's more complicated than that. Oftentimes, the problem is knowing what exactly does obedience entail. What does God require of me? We know the commandments, but how do those translate into our situation? Now, it seems like there's a what could Adam and Eve not have understood about the commandment that was given to them? There's a sense in which that's probably true. It didn't take a lot of thought to know what God required of them at one level. But at another level, it did take thought, and that is, what is God doing here? What are the values that gave rise to this commandment? And that takes a lot of thought. There's a lot that is to be gained from thinking about the commandments. That is, we can learn a lot about our Creator, the one who gave the commandments, and we can learn a lot about ourselves, the one who made us, from the one who made us, and the relationship between the two of us, what that ought to be. So there's a sense in which it seems to me Adam and Eve missed out on an opportunity. They did not meditate on the commandment that had been given to them, and they missed out on a learning opportunity, an opportunity to learn about themselves and to learn about God. What I was arguing last time is, I think that the text is indicating that they could have learned something from thinking about why it is that this God, who had been so good to them, would put restrictions on them. How could the same God do both things, be good to them and put restrictions on them? And had they thought about that in the context of God's goodness and all that he had done for them, without the influence of the serpent, I think they could have made some progress along that route. But they apparently did not, and therefore they were not ready for the temptation when it came. As I understand what God is doing in life, to a large extent, life is a big puzzle. There's a lot for us to figure out. And the commandments that God has given are a big hint as to how to put all the pieces of that puzzle together. It's kind of like, even though I haven't played it, the Myst game. I haven't played it, I've only heard about it. But it's like the commandments are a clue that we're told to pay attention to. Because the commandments that God has given, all that he has told us about what is right and what is wrong, those all come from his understanding of the world, from his worldview. And therefore, we can use those commandments to reconstruct his view of the world. And his view of the world is the view of the world that we want to adopt as our own, because he is the creator. When God gave the commandments to the Israelites in the desert, when they were given the second time, actually, Moses included this statement before he listed the commandments in Deuteronomy. It says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates." That's interesting that there would be so much emphasis put upon the commandments themselves. But I hadn't, in the past, I've always thought, well, that's so that they remembered them. It's so that they memorized them. I suspect that's not really what it's talking about. What it's talking about is so that they understood them, so that they could understand the worldview that generated those commandments. I've used this illustration before. It's the best one that I can think of. When we as parents tell our children, do this and don't do that, those rules that we come up with, they don't come out of nowhere. All of those rules are generated from my understanding of what is right and wrong, what is valuable and what is not valuable, what is good and what is bad. If you were to take all of the commandments that I have given to my children and put them together, you would have a pretty good representation of my perspective on the world. And it is God's perspective on the world that we want to reconstruct by looking at his commandments. They all came from that, and therefore they all point back to it. So there is a sense in which the commandments are hints or clues to something much bigger, and that is a whole perspective on the world. So there's a sense in which simple obedience is not what God wants. Ultimately, what God wants is for us to understand the world and see it the way he sees it, through his eyes. Now, there's another sense in which God doesn't want simply obedience. I remember reading in Reader's Digest, not yeah, Reader's Digest, sometime a long time ago, an anecdote. And all I remember is the punchline. I don't remember the rest of it, so I won't even try to reconstruct it. But there was a boy who, his parent was trying to get him to sit down, and he didn't want to sit down. And the last line was, the boy finally sat down. He said, "I'm sitting down, but inside I'm still standing." That's a wonderful image for me of defiance or rebelliousness. And it is possible for us to be simply obedient and yet be rebels. And so simple obedience is not really what God's after. What God is after is, what he's more interested in is that we be committed to what he's committed to, that we love what he loves. In other words, if God had to choose between us sitting down and standing up on the inside, or standing up but sitting down on the inside, he'd opt for the latter. But what he wants is that our heart be committed to what's right, not simple obedience. I was watching television recently, and the TV was on the station that has stuff about computers all the time. I don't even remember what channel it is. But they were talking about this new game, which is really hard for me to believe. It's a computer game that's becoming very popular. I guess you sign up and you're given an identity, and you're given a, I don't know if you've given a job. I don't know how you get started. But basically, you live a virtual life. You go out and you buy a house and you go to work, and you have these situations with your family, your virtual family, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I have a difficult time fitting my life into 24 hours a day. I don't know how I could do mine and another one, but I guess there are people with time on their hands. In any case, I was thinking about that. I wonder how people live in the virtual lives and how different that is from their real lives. There's a little experiment that Plato talks about in The Republic. He's talking about justice. He's trying to figure out who is a truly just person. And he talks about this myth of a fellow who found a ring, and if he turned the ring with the facet to the inside of his hand, he disappeared. And what did this fellow do when he discovered he could disappear? Well, he became involved in all kinds of wickedness. He became a thief and an adulterer and all kinds of things. And his point was, if you can get away with no consequences, then what will you do? Well, think about this virtual life. What if you could live with no consequences? How would you live? Let's make it even more severe. Let's say that in this virtual life, you suffer for doing good. Now what are you going to do? How would you live your life? What would it look like? What kinds of things would you engage in, and what wouldn't you engage in? What God would like is for us to get to the place where we fully embrace as being valuable everything that he values, such that we do good out of preference. We do good because we've developed a taste for righteousness. Ultimately, that's what he wants. Not simple obedience, but rather embracing righteousness with our whole being, with our whole soul, such that even if there were no consequences for doing wrong, we still would stay away from it, not because we're afraid of the consequences, but because it's wrong. We don't like it. In response to the Pharisees, at one point, Jesus said, what God wants is compassion, not sacrifice. And I think that's the concept that he's capturing there. What God wants from us is for us to agree with our soul, with him, a loyalty, a solidarity with him as to what is righteous and what is good, not sacrifice. Okay. Now, that was Don's question. And then Debbie asked a question, and I can't remember what your question was, Debbie, but I started thinking about some things that you said in leading up to your question that got me thinking. One of the things that Debbie's comments triggered in my mind is, how could Adam and Eve have learned, how could they even have suspected that they might be vulnerable to the temptation that was to come along? I mean, is it realistic to have thought that they could have, if they had thought about the commandment, they could have reached the point where they would have resisted temptation? I think it is true that earlier in the day, Adam and Eve, probably if you had asked them, would you even be tempted to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? I suspect they would have said no, no way. I mean, isn't that the way we all are? We just assume that there are certain things that we are not temptable by. We cannot be tempted by. For instance, if God were to issue an 11th commandment, thou shalt not listen to country western music, I'd be safe. I mean, there are some things that I am not temptable by. But as we're young and as we're growing up, we lump a lot of things in those category. I mean, if you ask the average college student or high school student, what are the things that you could be tempted by? And they're going to put a lot more in that basket than they will when they're 40 or 50. Because I think we have all experienced this. As we go through life, temptations can be packaged in such a way that they hit us right where we're weak, in ways that we didn't realize that we were prior to that. But there's a sense in which life probes us for our weak spots. And what we discover is we've got weak spots where we didn't even think we had spots. So life is a constant series of revelations to us about who we are and what really makes us tick, what we really value when it comes down to it, and what we don't value. So there's a sense in which I think it is unrealistic to believe that had they meditated on the commandment, they could ever have reached the point of self-knowledge without experience of their failings, that they could have reached a point of self-knowledge where they could have realized their vulnerability. I don't think they realized it at all. However, when we think about Jesus, Jesus was born as a man, and he was able to come to a point of self-knowledge such that he understood the nature of the temptations that were presented to him and was able to resist those temptations. So it is humanly possible in a sense, but in another sense, as we all know, our self-knowledge comes as a result of experience. Experience combined with revelation, that we as sinners can't see ourselves well. We refuse to see ourselves well, ultimately. And it takes failings for us to be faced into those areas in which we are weak, if even then we will face into it. Okay. But what God is doing in history is he wants to make us into truly righteous beings who we will have in the new life, we will have experienced evil. There's a sense in which it's ironic. Adam and Eve did come to know good and evil in a way that they didn't anticipate. They knew evil in that they experienced it, and they experienced their own evil. We have all experienced evil and will continue to experience evil. And in our new life, we will not be temptable by the tree of the knowledge of good and evil or any other temptation of evil, because we have experienced it, we know what it is, and we have no taste for it. And that is what God is working on in us. That's his goal. Okay. With, then, the events in the garden, history begins. And history is a process whereby mankind is going to develop this notion of becoming like God. Man was born in the garden. It was made by God in his image. So there's something about us that is like God and yearns to be like God, and that is good and proper. But in the garden, what man chose was to be like God in the sense of having his power and his authority. That's what we would like. That's our flaw. We were not designed to be gods in that sense, but that's the sense in which we would like to be gods. We would like to be able to arrange and orchestrate all of our circumstances, everything in our lives, to our liking. I would like, for instance, for the weather to be good today, sunny and 72. The problem is, we all learn this very quickly, we can't do it. We would like to be gods, but we're creatures. We would like to be creators, but we're creatures. We would like to be in control of everything, but we're just a half notch above the animals. And there's a frustration that comes from that, and an insecurity. But we as God wannabes, we try to orchestrate everything to our liking. And we try to create our own salvation. History, then, my understanding of history is that it is man's search. Man has turned in rebellion against God, is pretending to be a God himself, But he doesn't have the power. So man is constantly on the search for a power source that will allow him to manipulate his surroundings and his environment to his liking. We have, we know that we are going to die, which is a frustration to us. We have limited resources, which is a frustration to us. We have limited intelligence, which is a frustration to us. We have limited power, which is a frustration to us. And there are moral constraints placed on us, which is a frustration to us. All of those are frustrating to us. So history, from the time of Adam and Eve to the present, has been a process whereby mankind has tried to free himself from all of those limitations, one by one. And ultimately, we have done that the best by concentrating on the here and now, this world, manipulating stuff. And we've done that best by working in cooperation. So all of history has been a process of trial and error whereby man has found ways to organize in which he can stay together and work together, making progress with respect to stuff. So, for instance, we can now fly. We have overcome the limitation, one of the limitations, physical limitations placed on us. We can get an airplane and we can fly. We have computers. We have overcome some of the limitation on our intelligence. We've got even supercomputers. In the field of medicine, we've made great strides in prolonging life. So we've made some progress in the limitation on our lifespan, our mortality. Any place you look, we have made progress in pushing back the limits that were placed on us, at least in some sense. And I think what we're going to see is that as time goes on, mankind is going to make even further progress in those areas. And what we're going to see at the very end is man in all of his manness. That the world will display in human society what man really is. And it's going to be horrifying. Because we're going to see man in all of his arrogance, rebelliousness, and lawlessness. Because man has been freeing himself from all of those constraints throughout the whole history of mankind. That is one part of history. That is one side of history, that God has turned things loose in such a way that man will show himself for who he really is in independence from God. There is another history that's happening at the same time and started at the same time. And that is a redemptive history. That God is entering into human affairs, and God is determined that he will take a remnant out of mankind, and through his activity, he will display the image of God differently. The first history is man pretending to be God. The second history is God making man in his own image. So through the process of God entering into the lives of a remnant. God is going to transform those people. And he is going to make them love what he loves, value what he values, and be good reflections of the character of God. And in that way, become God-like and display the image of God. And he has done that through the work of Christ and through the work of the Holy Spirit in our lives as he transforms us and brings us to the place where we love righteousness, truly love righteousness. And coming to love righteousness is an acquired taste. It's something that we have to learn and that he is building into us. But one day, that will be our preference. Righteousness will be our preference. And we won't even give a second thought to grasping for equality with God. I don't know how many questions there are going to be. Let me just open it up for questions and
I was talking with a friend the other day about this whole our gradually overcoming our limitations and how it seems like for every good thing that comes along, it brings with it in its wake something terrible. It's probably not a theme I have to elaborate on a whole lot, but my question is, my friend who's not a believer was saying, sort of grudgingly admitting, yes, you know, every time something, we come along with some good thing, it brings along with it some horror, sort of in proportion to the miraculousness of the good thing that it brings along, mm-hmm. So that it seems like it's, we were sort of asking ourselves, is this a break-even thing such that it doesn't really matter? Is life really not any better now than it was? Or is life worse? Is life better? Is it the same or is it worse? If it's worse, does that mean that the wise man would reject all technology or at least would wish that we could go back to the time when we had polio because we had no polio vaccine, or we couldn't send men to the moon because we didn't have computers that could do the calculations reliably enough, or something like that. So I was just wondering how you would answer that question. Are we a little bit ahead, break even? Are we behind such that if we could turn back and get rid of all the technology, we would?
Are we better or are we worse? I think that's a hard one to answer. My guess would be that we're worse off. But it doesn't really matter because there's no going back. There's no way. If I am right, there was something inevitable about us getting here. That it was what history is the revelation of the nature of man, and it has been the nature of man that has driven history all the way along. At every turn, we made the turn that we did because it was more suited to the it was more fitting for the nature of man. There is a sense in which Clinton was inevitable. Maybe not this particular Clinton, but someone with his basic attributes, becoming the ruler of a large nation in the world, was inevitable. Because we have been attracted all the way along, at every turn in history, in this direction, towards, throughout history, we've been attracted to a worldview that says this is all there is, that stuff is all there is. And the thing that has lured us along this trail has always been cool stuff. That there's more cool stuff down this road than there is down any other road. And that's what's brought us to where we are. I would even say the decentralization of power, that democracy was inevitable. Because it gets more cool stuff in the hands of more people than anything else. So there's a sense in which where we have come was inevitable, and there is no going back. The only, unless we are to withdraw from society completely, we can't go back. We will not persuade society to go back. That will never happen. Because it's our lusts that have got us here, and they haven't gone away. So, are we better off? I would say ultimately, spiritually, I think we are worse off. The only way in which we are better off is in stuff. But that's a dubious good. We do have more stuff. But as far as our souls, our spirits, I think there's a sense in which they've probably suffered. But that's not to say that if we were to go back, if we were all to give up our lives here and become hunters and gatherers in the woods, that wouldn't make us better people. There's still the question of how we are going to respond. But the environment is of the hunter and gatherer is probably ultimately more conducive to piety than life as a businessman in downtown New York City. And the reason is because the businessman in downtown New York City sees virtually no connection between his life and his well-being and God, whereas the hunter and gatherer sees a direct connection between his well-being and some force beyond him and beyond man.
Later on, you're going to get, I presume, to the Tower of Babel incident, and the reason God confused their speech was because, you know, once man sets his mind to something, if they work together, they're going to be able to accomplish anything. And it seems like with the global village thing that we have now, where interestingly, English seems to be coming, becoming the Koine language of the world, and what God said, if they put their mind to it, they're going to be able to accomplish anything that's happening. Right. So it seems like what God did with the Tower of Babel only put off the inevitable.
Yes.
And now he's going to allow that to happen.
Yes, exactly. I think that's exactly right. That the Tower of Babel was an incident in which the nature of mankind was exhibited, and God stepped in, but it was premature. God didn't want it to happen full-blown at that point. God stepped in, and he frustrated it. He made communication difficult, and therefore cooperation difficult. They could not then achieve the great things that they had set out to do. But now, over the course of time, God has allowed even more of the groundwork to be laid, in preparation for a time when we're going to see, I think, a repetition of the Tower of Babel on a much grander scale and a much more impressive kind of display.
Part of my question, I guess, that I didn't make explicit, is the idea, you were talking about our inevitably taking the path that produces more stuff. But stuff in itself is not inherently evil. It's just if you value stuff over anything else, that is inherently evil. Mm-hmm. So some people might argue that we ought to reject anything which causes us to take the path of people who act as if stuff is all is everything. It seems to me, though, that since stuff in itself is not evil, if I have a computer, even though people have done bad things with computers, computer technology is here, there's no reason why, if my values are correct, I shouldn't avail myself of stuff to the extent that it allows me to pursue good values.
Right, no, I think that's absolutely right. The problem is we have sold our souls for stuff. As a society, as a culture, we've sold our souls for stuff. We've made stuff life. We've called stuff life. And we have pursued it at all ends. And it's that complete misunderstanding of what life is all about that has got us to the place where we are. But as sinners, rebellious against God, and beings that want to be autonomous from God, it is our inclination to see something else as life other than what is really life, and it's turned out to be stuff.
Going back to last week, I was wondering if you could comment more on what exactly changed when they took of the fruit and rebelled. And you made some comments, and I wasn't sure if you were Adam and Eve subjected to the same entropy as we are, in that the world that they lived in, even though they hadn't rebelled yet, was still degenerating. And so were they. And the animals around them were dying, and eventually they would have died. Some of the comments you made didn't sound like they were supporting that, and I was curious to see what...
Well, I'm still deciding some of those questions in my own mind. The more I look at the passage and think about the passage, the more I'm inclined to see Adam and Eve as not being all that different from us. I used to think that Adam and Eve, before they ate the fruit, they were different beings, significantly different beings, that there was no decay, that there was no sin, there was complete fellowship with God, complete unity with God in a sense, all that sort of thing. But that's hard because they at least had the weakness, the vulnerability before they ate of the fruit. So what is that vulnerability? And as I think more about that, it seems more likely that even before they ate of the fruit, they were much more like us. And quite possibly, they would have died even if they hadn't eaten the fruit. But when they ate of the fruit, there is something that changed, and that is they became aware of their weakness, their vulnerability. They became actual sinners rather than potential sinners. the rebellion was manifested in actual action. So there was something that changed. But it could be that primarily what's happening when God talks to them afterwards, the section we'll get to next, that what he's saying is, now these things are going to happen, and they are directly related to your sinfulness. They would have happened ultimately anyway. But now this act gives significance to what I'm going to tell you about your life and what it's going to be like. I suspect that their life before the eating of the fruit was not, they didn't experience the kind of frustration and distance from God that they experience afterwards, alienation from God that they experience afterwards. But I'm not sure that the lack of alienation was due to their innate goodness before they ate of it, rather than simply God's graciousness towards them.
I just have a comment to make that I brought up, brought up as you were saying that when we think about people who are not believers and about them being blind, then you think about Adam and Eve before they ate. It's almost as though they were blind to their sin, and eating made them aware, and it's kind of what happens to us is mm-hmm. when we become Christians, that mm-hmm. prior to becoming a Christian, we were blind too. I don't know. It was mm-hmm. just interesting. Mm-hmm.
Oh. Our blindness to ourselves is probably one of the most formidable problems that we have. We do not see ourselves well. We think we do. But it really takes an act of God for us to see ourselves. What we see is what we would like to be rather than what we are. And all the evidence that we have, we play with the evidence in such a way that it all points to us being what we would like to be rather than what we are. But it takes an act of God, ultimately, for us to see ourselves. Adam and Eve could have eaten of the fruit and still not seen themselves as sinners. We see that in chapter 4, where Cain kills his brother and yet doesn't see himself as a sinner at the end of it. So we are certainly capable of doing that. We are capable of enormous amounts of self-deception.
Your comment about, forgive me if I'm not quoting you directly, but the essence of Adam and Eve's rebellion being a desire to become the gods of their own life and to manipulate circumstances such as to overcome the restrictions that God had placed on them just made me think of the popular prosperity gospel that is so common in the church today, and it made me think how ultimately idolatrous that mm-hmm. is.
Mm-hmm. What we are attracted to as sinners is power. What we would like is power and control. And anything that gives us some kind of promise of more power or control is, we go for it. That's what we want. And that's our weakness.
This question comes out of some confusion that I'm struggling with in terms of, first of all, knowing the blindness, knowing how incredibly blind I still am, even after God really getting my attention in many big ways, I'm still confronted with that. When people tell me things about myself, mm-hmm. I still naturally want to say, you are so off. And let me just explain why. And that desire to just tell, to control reality instead of sit down when God asked me to. So this comes out of something in there, this question, and I had it last week, and in some ways you've responded to it, but not exactly like this. So if you could help me out. Could you, if we broke the kind of status or the condition of man into three different periods of time, could you comment on where you think what the condition is in each? In the pre-fall, that God has made us and we're good somehow, or something about it is good. The right after eating the apple, and then our hope, our inheritance, and what we will look like then. Could you break it up like that for me? Mm-hmm.
I'll try. And it's the pre-fall that's the most difficult for me, because I'm not real clear on it myself. But before they ate of the fruit, my assumption is that they were obedient and they were faithful. But it was a naive obedience and an untested faithfulness. They only had one commandment, and they were following it, but not because they were committed to doing what was right. They just didn't have the occasion to do wrong or the impetus to do wrong. No temptation had come along. So it was faithfulness out of no option. Really. The fall, when they eat of the apple, the temptation is they have an option. That instead of trusting God, they can trust themselves. And that one is too hard to pass up. That looks really attractive because they know that at least they are interested. They are concerned about their own self-interest. No one's more concerned about their self-interest than they are. That's the way they see it. So they eat of the apple or the fruit. In our next life, we will have experienced evil. Such that, in this life, evil has an attraction to us. Even as believers, evil has its appeal, and we know that all too well. It is by the grace of God that we resist temptation and don't do evil. In the life to come, evil will have no attraction for us. Because God will have completely transformed us in such a way that we will look at evil and we'll say, why would I want to do that? I know it for what it is. I know what it leads to. I know that God is good and that God has said that that is wrong. And it will hold no attraction for us whatsoever. It will be like country western music. So that's the transformation that I see happening. God is taking us from being faithful but naive, faithful because we don't really see the alternatives, to a point where we have experienced evil and good in such a way that in the new heavens and the new earth, we will embrace righteousness wholly, and wickedness will hold no interest for us at all. More question?
Not at the moment, thanks.
Okay. Ann had it. Yeah.
Maybe you've already addressed this, but you mentioned that Adam and Eve last week, you mentioned several times that they had died spiritually that day. Mm-hmm. And if you could just pull into a nutshell what that means to you. I mean, I understand the awareness and their shame, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure what you mean by, were they spiritually alive before and not alive at all afterward, or I'm not sure what you mean.
I'm guessing, but my guess is the goodness that we have, our obedience to God, our faithfulness to God, is a gift from God. My guess is that before the fall, God granted them that. That God granted them the grace that allowed them to be faithful, to the grace that made it possible for the earth, for instance, to respond to their labor, the grace for the relationship between Adam and Eve to be harmonious, etc., etc., etc. That they experienced grace in all of those different aspects of their lives. And that after the fall, they died in the sense that God withdrew that. They are not, God is, was not going to allow them to be rebels and enjoy his grace. Be rebels and have life. Because to be rebels and to be able to live eternally, to have life, would have been the worst combination. So God withdrew that grace. They begin to experience then guilt, alienation, all kinds of futility. And that's the death that I think God is talking about. Any other questions?